Welcome to the Gravity Well podcast. I am Jenny Aramie. I host the Gravity Well to celebrate and share the stories of people looking to empower others with the knowledge and skills required to reestablish stability in our communities and ecosystems. Our mission is to work through heavy issues in conversation and process in order to lighten the load. I acknowledge that I live on the traditional territories of Treaty 7 and in Métis Districts 5 and 6. The treaties and self-governance agreements established by Indigenous peoples were created to honor the laws of the land, maintain balance with nature by giving back, and uphold reciprocal relationships. This knowledge and intention are what guide the Gravity Well conversations. I ask for genuine dialogue, real hearts, and openness to different perspectives. This is your invitation to find common ground with me. This podcast is dedicated to the natural world, our children, nieces, nephews, grandchildren, and all future generations. The Gravity Well is on YouTube and streaming wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you see and hear, remember to like and subscribe. Thank you all for being here. I'm very pleased to announce that I've got a co-host for the next series of conversations that I'm hosting on the Gravity Well. We are talking about water in Southern Alberta over the next, hopefully, 7 or 8 weeks. Why are we talking about this? So we're hoping to reach out to the general public. We want to help people that are involved in water management, have people understand the work that you do. That's what we have for two guests with us today. And as well as an introduction of the series of conversations. So we want to cover irrigation, the environment, stewardship, and the future. So just to remind you both, it's very nice to see you again, Shannon. So I'm a geophysicist by background, Jordan, and I worked in the oil and gas industry for 22 years, and I've been looking out at it from the outside now for 3, and water has become a central concern of mine. So just, you know, the way we use water with respect to resource development, the concerns around continuing that in some regards, and then also just looking at limits and where we need to start thinking differently in Southern Alberta. So that's my introduction. Bob, if you wouldn't mind taking a little bit of time telling people a bit about yourself and what brought you to this conversation with me. Thank you.
Sure. I'm Bob Morrison, and I'm a planner, now retired by profession. And I've worked in transportation, water management, and since my retirement in municipal issues here in Calgary. And I'm very interested in water still, even though that's in my past career, because it's becoming increasingly important for Southern Alberta and the rest of the world. There is a need out there for serious education about where we are, how we got there, and where we need to be going in the future, because we can take many directions towards the future, and those have to be made with a lot of understanding, again, about what our situation is and how we can make it better. The important thing for me is to how to keep the things that are good and then deal with those things that, well, maybe they're not working so well. So thanks, Jenny. Back to you.
Excellent. Thank you. So again, this conversation is focused on irrigation. Really pleased to have Shannon back. Shannon has you can get into it for us, but has just recently written a book all about the history of agriculture. And if anybody has been following the show, Shannon was a part of our conversation last year. In episode 18, we spoke about drought in the prairies and the history of that issue over the last 100 years or more. And Jordan is from the special areas, so he'll be introducing himself shortly. And we also reached out to a few other people that we would have liked to have represented in this conversation. So the Alberta Irrigation District Association, the Ministry of Agriculture and Irrigation, as well as the Ministry of Environment and Protected Areas. So Bob's going to fill us in a little bit on some of those spaces that we would like to include in this conversation. But let's start with your introductions, please. So Shannon, would you mind reintroducing yourself for our audience, please? Thank you.
Of course, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm an associate professor of history at the University of Alberta. I work in the environmental history of the Canadian Prairie West with particular attention to issues related to water, too much, too little, questions of equity.
Excellent. And Jordan, please, your background as well.
Thanks, Jenny, and I appreciate the invite to join in on this conversation here this morning. So I'm Jordan Christensen. I was the chairperson for the Special Areas Board up until the end of March. It's kind of a unique role, especially ours as a unique organization in the province. We're kind of around HANA Concert Oyen. We really function as a rural municipality, but we kind of have a dual role. Part of our primary role is provision of municipal services. We also act as a public land manager. So there's about 2.5 million acres of public land within our region that the board also manages. And, you know, we lease that out for various uses throughout the special areas. And then that's kind of where this chairperson role sits. It is a provincial appointment through an order in council by cabinet. So as I said, I was the chair for the past 10 years. My term expired after 10 years, and so we're kind of in a transition right now, but I still am currently with special areas doing just some project work and helping the board with some of the other, you know, kind of priority initiatives that they're interested in pursuing at this point in time. So glad to be here.
Thank you. Excellent. Glad to know you have 10 years of chairing this work so that you have a broad experience, I'm sure, to share with us today. Okay, so let's let Bob do a little bit of an overview for us. Here we go.
Okay, this is because the people from the Irrigation Districts Association and from the provincial government weren't able to join us today. So this is a very brief, cursory overview of irrigation in Southern Alberta. Irrigation is big business in Southern Alberta. And this chart shows how irrigation compares to the other uses in the basin. I can't use my pointer, so I'll just have to talk about it. If you look at the light blue area, that is what irrigation is about. And it's broken up into four basins in the south here. The Red Deer sub-basin, which flows through Red Deer and then on into and by the special areas. Then the Bow Basin, which is goes through Banff, Canmore, Calgary, and on down towards Medicine Hat. The Old Man Basin, which is in the Lethbridge area. And then there's a small chunk of the basin called the South Saskatchewan sub-basin, which starts when the Bow and the Old Man join up near Medicine Hat. The distribution of use is very much different in the basins. You can see in the Red Deer, irrigation is accounting for only 21% of the total allocation, whereas in the Bow and the Old Man, you're talking about 80% of the water that's allocated goes to irrigation. And then you've got a small chunk of it down in the Medicine Hat area. The big difference, though, is what's in red there, the total allocation. You'll see in the Red Deer Basin, the total allocation is like 270,000 acre feet. But you move to the Bow, and it's got 2 million acre feet of water allocated. The Old Man is similar at 1.8 million, and then you've got a little bit of allocation down in the sub-basin that's just down near Medicine Hat. Even though those circles look the same, When you talk about acre feet, the Old Man and Bow circles would be much, much larger. Now, in terms of where you find this irrigation, there are two kinds of irrigation in Southern Alberta. One is through irrigation districts, and that's the little map on the left-hand side. There are 13 of those irrigations, and they're all marked in those colored areas, whether it's kind of gray up by Calgary, where the Western Irrigation District is, kind of that brown area, which is the Eastern Irrigation District, the yellow area running kind of way across the prairies there, which is the St. Mary's Irrigation District. So they are actually organized to provide irrigation to farmers. They have their own works, many of which are supplied by provincial projects, provincial water works. Then on the right, you can see individual irrigation licenses. You can see them spread all the way through there, and you really can't see it very well, but kind of in the right-hand side in the center and above that, that's where the special areas is. So you can see some private irrigation in the special areas. These private irrigators generally just take water straight out of the river. Sometimes they are associated with irrigation districts in some fashion, but aren't necessarily ratepayers. So you've got an extensive amount of people who in one way or another are dedicated and depend upon irrigation. Now, in terms of the total acreage, overall, there's about 1.8 million, maybe a little bit more because this is from 2023, 1.8 million acres of irrigation, which, as Jordan said, 2.5 million of acres that the Special Areas Board manages the irrigated area in total in southern Alberta is coming pretty close to that magnitude of land. If you look at the bottom, that green line going across, hopefully it showed up green on your screens, that is private irrigation. So most of the irrigation in terms of the acres irrigated is coming from these irrigation districts as opposed to private irrigation. So that gives you a general sense of what irrigation is like in the southern South Saskatchewan River Basin. It's kind of giving the end of discussion before we actually talk about how we got there, but I figured people needed that kind of perspective. Thanks.
Okay, so Shannon, your latest book, Transforming the Prairies, is a history of the PFRA, that is the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration. The PFRA's overall objective was to make adjustments to agriculture, primarily in Alberta and Saskatchewan. Can you describe for us the agricultural challenges that led to the formation of the PFRA?
Sure. So the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration was a federal government agency that was created in the mid-1930s, 1935, to deal with a range of difficult circumstances in the agricultural Prairie West. These difficult circumstances included the consequences derived from extremely low prices for farm commodities like wheat, related to the international economic crisis of the Great Depression. The problems in the 1930s that led to the creation of the PFRA also included the effects on farms and farmers of lower than anticipated rates of precipitation, dry conditions, what people in what's now southern Alberta saw as dry conditions. And they also included things like the accumulating consequences of unsustainable farming practices that were part of sort of the early effort to establish colonized agriculture in the Prairie West at the end of the 1800s and into the 1900s. Another aspect that I think is worth considering when we're thinking about southern Alberta is that southern Alberta is part of a dryland landscape, and dryland landscapes are evident globally. So it fits into this international set of environments that share certain features. And one of sort of the global commonalities among dryland environments is that they've often been misunderstood and misused, typically by colonial powers, without rich understandings of these environments and their affordances. So some of the circumstances that led to the PFRA are really specific to this region, but they also play into broader global patterns that I think are worth appreciating.
Yeah, absolutely. I can. And do you see that happening in different waves, Shannon? Like, meaning today, you know, it seems that we, as Bob just showed in terms of that map, that we're still growing in terms of our water use in an area that you would describe as a dryland landscape.
Certainly irrigation and various ways of trying to use water for agricultural purposes are part of efforts to adapt, to seek something like compromise between these dryland landscapes and the goals of settler agriculture.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that. Okay. So Jordan, for you, the collapse of dryland farming in the 1920s and 30s was particularly devastating in the areas around Hannah and Oyen. And it wasn't just farmers that were going broke. The entire economy and social structures were under threat. Can you outline the formation of the special areas as a response to that damage that occurred, please?
Sure. Thanks, Jenny. And I think you could just, you know, take the comments that Shannon had just made on the creation of the PFRA and really, you know, the creation of the Special Areas Board kind of, you know, I'd say in many ways parallels the creation of that federal agency, the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration. You know, I think one of the key differences was that obviously the Special Areas Board, it's a provincial crown agency, but it was created in response to much of the same issues that really resulted in the formation and the creation of the PFRA. Really what had happened was in the early days of European settlement in Western Canada, you had a federal government that had these grand ambitions to have settlers come and homestead on every quarter section of the West. And that was really in blatant disregard to, you know, to the recommendations of a gentleman named Captain John Palliser, who, when he surveyed the area in the late 1800s, said that, you know, part of this area in southeastern Alberta that Shannon referenced as being extremely arid. I think he clearly outlined to the federal government of the day that this area was really not, I think his quote was, not suitable for man nor beast. And he didn't think that it should be settled. And, you know, the federal government disregard to that recommendation, you know, brought in, you know, thousands and thousands of European settlers. And in fact, the irony to me today in, you know, what is the current boundary of special areas, our population actually peaked in the late 1920s, about 1929. And we had just about 30,000 residents in this area, whereas today we're barely over 4,000 people rurally. If we add the populations of the urban settlements, like the town of Hanna and the village Concert and Hanna, and then we have a couple other villages, Youngstown, Veteran, Empress, we might be at a regional population of about 10,000 within the area. But the population actually peaked here in the late 20s. And then, you know, through successive droughts, and then in the financial collapse of the 1930s, you know, what had happened was that created a situation where a lot of the settlers, they were going broke themselves. They couldn't even afford to pay their property taxes at the time. And so then that resulted in approximately 37, I'll say, rural municipalities or local governments. They couldn't, you know, meet their cash obligations, and they going into basically bankruptcy because they had no cash. And so at that point in the mid to late 30s, the government created this organization to stabilize that region. And they created the Special Areas Board. And what they did was they took those 37 municipalities that had went broke. And again, the area of the special areas has consolidated since the late 30s. It used to stretch all the way, you know, through Vulcan County, north of Lethbridge. You know, now it's kind of centered around the communities of Hanna, Concert, Noyon. But consolidated those local governments into one governing organization. They took all the land that had been taken back under tax recovery proceedings and basically, you know, gave that to the Special Areas Board. And then all the provincial crown land that was in the region, they basically, I'll say, loaned that to the board and said, here, you know, take these land holdings. Just because of the arid conditions, is impractical for settlers to make a living on a single quarter section. You know, so the objective of the board was to create these larger farm and ranch units that were more sustainable and more economically viable by providing them with more land. So it was really those conditions that led to the formation of the special areas. And again, we still exist as a provincial crown organization with the dual role of, you know, providing municipal services, but still maintaining that other core function of being a public land manager and, you know, supporting producers in this area by providing leases and dispositions for public lands to carry out farm and ranch activities on. So again, like the creation of the PFRA and the special areas followed very similar trajectories, and they were in response to, you know, many of the same conditions.
That is fascinating. It's fascinating to think the population was nearly 10 times the size that it is today, and to just imagine that collapse of society based on a going in knowingly that it's not going to succeed scenario. That's just fascinating. Bob, did you have any follow-up before you lead into the next question?
Yeah, and one thing the special areas didn't have that a lot of Southern Alberta had was irrigation. There were big irrigation works that people had been trying to build. They weren't terribly successful. Even the powerful CPR got out of the irrigation business, but there were works that the PFRA could actually manage in some fashion, rehabilitate, to help those areas that had suffered through the 20s and the 30s. But I was interested in terms of the special areas, how they've changed over time. You've mentioned a couple of things, but have there been significant changes, or has the special areas pretty much remained the same in terms of the way they govern the area?
I think, Bob, like, I mean, obviously we have evolved, you know, since the kind of the original act that we go back to as the you know, the foundation of how we were created goes back to 1938. And, you know, there has been modifications and some changes made to that structure. Generally, I would say, though, that, you know, again, our core role and function still remains the same. The board's mandate is the provision of municipal services. So part of their duties and responsibilities is much like any other rural municipality. It's roads, it's hamlet services, it's utility, water, wastewater, emergency services, parks, recreation, those types of activities that you'd see in other municipalities throughout the province. But then added to that, again, it is the public land management role. So the board does have, a group of staff that actively manages those 2.5 million acres through agricultural dispositions like grazing leases to ranching operations. There still are some, I'll say cultivation leases on arable farmland out there that producers, farm annual crops on. And then we have all the industrial dispositions, mineral surface leases for oil and gas exploration south of Hannett, the Sheerness mine, where coal mining activities had historically taken place, managing some of those dispositions on public lands. So really our core function remains the same, but obviously, the way we do it and, the priorities that the board has now in terms of the activities and how they go about governance, have changed. I'll say significantly over that time, but really the kind of the core foundation of our business is still the same.
Sure. Now, Shannon, Jordan mentioned John Palliser, but there was another John out on the prairies back in the 1800s, a guy named John McCowan. And he was telling the CPR and the federal government that this was the Garden of Eden out here, that, agriculture was gonna make it. It didn't turn out that way, obviously. And then the PFRA had to step in, particularly in the southern part of the area. What were the key initiatives that the PFRA put in place to adjust, and that's really what they were trying to do, adjust agriculture on the prairies?
Sure. So the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration was a sprawling agency that operated for many, many decades. So it tackled a whole range of challenges and activities in that context. But in the sort of the rush of the 1930s crisis, the PFRA worked directly with farmers in lots of ways to refine agricultural practices. And the PFRA also relied on expert input to assess what might be more likely to be viable in terms of these agricultural practices, and also to plan for what the agency hoped would be a more prosperous and more enduring agriculture in the Prairie West. Some of the agency's best known early activities included the Small Water Development Program, which was basically a program through which farmers could access resources and supports to undertake the creation of small scale water supplies, like dams or dugouts, small reservoirs on their own property. Sometimes these were used for private garden irrigation. Other early initiatives of the PFRA that are pretty important includes one that was most significant in Saskatchewan, the creation of what were called community pastures, government-managed areas in which farmers could graze their livestock, both as a means of putting to productive use lands that were thought to not be suitable for ongoing annually cropped farm practice, but also in service to the ideal of more diversified agriculture, that farms might prove more enduring and sustainable if they had both wheat crops and cattle in this model. And in this period, some of the experts that I've already talked about working with the PFRA were involved in sort of assessing water resources and soil resources across the Prairie West. Efforts that underpinned later large-scale projects that the PFRA would undertake, like the construction of St. Mary Dam in southern Alberta, and later the construction of Gardner Dam, the Capel River Dam, and the creation of Lake Diefenbaker in central Saskatchewan. And both of these projects have really important links to ongoing irrigation practices in both these provinces. And the PFRA did a bunch more stuff, as you do if you're an agency in operation for 80 years or so, but perhaps I'll leave it there for now.
Okay.
Great. Just following up on that, Shannon, can you speak to the, so there was fixing and adding new irrigation works is probably what the PFRA is most known for, if that's right. And the PFRA believed that irrigators in their districts would be unable to afford on their own to cover the cost of building and operating, maintaining dams, canals, and other infrastructure. So how did the PFRA respond to that challenge?
Maybe it's hopeful here, and hopefully this sort of expands a little bit in a productive manner on the bit of the summary of irrigation that Bob started us off with. So irrigation in Alberta was already underway privately by the final years of the 1800s. By sort of the 1920s and 1930s, however, it had become clear that neither private irrigation neither corporate irrigation undertaken by private for-profit entities like the CPR, nor irrigation undertaken under the cooperative model, the drainage district model, was likely to be viable sort of as a standalone financing model. It was clear that if irrigation was going to continue to expand or even be pretty stable in its current form, public funds and public resources were going to need to be directed at irrigation. And after the creation of the PFRA in the mid-1930s, that became a vehicle to direct public resources, or one of the vehicles to direct public resources toward irrigation in Alberta and in Saskatchewan primarily.
Well, now, Jordan, you've actually got some irrigation now from the Red Deer River, I gather. Is it the Sheerness Deadfish Project? Am I getting the name right?
Yeah, that's certainly one source of irrigation we have, Bob. And I'll admit, I thought it was, I appreciated the invite to attend this. I thought it was maybe a little bit odd at first that Special Areas was invited to a podcast on irrigation and water management, because we are not known for that, certainly in this part of the province. But, you know, I appreciated kind of your introductory presentation into this conversation, because as you've seen, like there are a number of private licenses held within this part of the province that support irrigation. One of kind of the primary pieces of agriculture or of infrastructure that we see irrigation happening on out here is related to the, I'll call it TransAlta's Sheerness generating station south of Hanna along Highway 36. So as part of that infrastructure development in the early 80s, they had constructed on a cooling pond, which was supplied by water via a pipeline out of the Red Deer River. And in order to maintain operations in that facility, they had to flush a certain level of water through it just to maintain operating temperatures. Part of the planning around that was using some of that water that is moved through the cooling pond just to maintain temperature, was utilizing that for irrigation purposes. So on the back end of that facility, I think there's about 12 or 13,000 acres of irrigation that happen off of that. And so there's infrastructure that's built out from, you know, the Sheerness generating station. It supports a reservoir kind of on the east side of Highway 36 along secondary Highway 570 called Carrollside. That then spills back into Berry Creek. And then there's irrigation along the blowdown canal in to Carrollside and then off of Berry Creek, you know, downstream of that Carrollside reservoir. And then we also have a number of irrigators within Special Areas and even into the MD of Acadia that have water licenses directly out of the Red Deer River, and they irrigate their operations right along the Red Deer River. So all in told, like that probably adds a few more thousand acres of irrigation within Special Areas, but you know, every little bit helps, and certainly we see, you know, those operations that have irrigation, very, very stable, you know, again, very successful operations in terms of, you know, the farm and ranch unit that's supporting. So all in all, I would suspect, I don't know the exact number, but, you know, if you say there's 12 to 13,000 acres tied onto the Sheerness system, you know, probably a few more thousand acres off the Red Deer River on private licenses and other, you know, as Shannon talked about, the PFRA program, you know, building catchment dams and just kind of across the landscape, there might be a few private licenses there. So maybe we're at 20, 25, 30,000 acres of irrigation within Special Areas. Certainly not to the extent that we've seen development in some of the other irrigation districts in southern Alberta, though.
Very small, yes. But has it made much difference in terms of the economy, do you think?
It has. Again, I kind of mentioned that maybe in passing there, that, you know, the operations that we that do exist out here that have access to irrigation, again, very stable, successful operations, and, you know, in their own right, to the point where actually we start to see, you know, some of the operations within Special Areas, they are, I don't want to say moving south, but they are, you know, going down into, say, the EID and trying to access irrigation land and other irrigation districts so that they can have stable feed sources for their operations. They're usually going in there and buying irrigation and then, you know, growing hay, and that helps support, you know, their operations within Special Areas. There's always demand for more irrigation on the Sheerness system. That group would certainly like to expand down there, but it is limited, obviously, by water, and it's, you know, kind of hinges on the volume of water that, you know, now TransAlta would pump up into the cooling pond and then release through that blowdown canal. And I'll admit too that that's maybe not necessarily the cheapest irrigation water. Obviously, if you're familiar with special areas, it's a vast, vast region in East Central Alberta. So there's great distances to convey water across, and you know, we're not often blessed by elevation either. And so got to apply energy to move water uphill. So that's been part of the challenge here as well, is just wrapping your head around, you know, some of those logistical challenges of moving water across landscapes.
Now, you and Shannon have both mentioned the combination of growing the crops, but also feeding the cattle, the community pastures, having some hay for your cattle. That seems to be, and maybe I'm not right about this, and this would be too bad we don't have the people from the agriculture department. That seems to be one of the key reasons why people like irrigation, is because there's this, I don't know, cross-fertilization. Maybe that's not the right term in agriculture, but you're growing the crops, and then you're going to be able to feed the cattle to much greater extent than you could if you were farming dry land. It's also providing security in terms of having that hay available when it wouldn't have naturally been available. Am I, Shannon, Jordan, heading in the right direction on that?
I think you're onto something there, Bob. I can't, you know, speak from a scientific analysis on this. I certainly think your comments are fair. I think it's an evolution thing. I mean, you look at some of the mature irrigation districts in the South that have really gotten into the high value cash crops, that potatoes, sugar beets, you know, like after they're grown, and there's a lot of processing that goes into them. I think with livestock feeding, like, and again, this is just my observation, I think it's really probably easy for a first time irrigator to grow a barley crop on irrigation. And it's just natural at that point, because your production is, obviously stable and greatly increased with water, you know, being applied at reliable intervals. Your production is so great to value add that it makes sense to maybe feed that to a beef animal, right? And so I think initially you kind of see that where you get a lot of wins early on with that kind of value added. But as irrigation develops and you start to see investment from, you know, secondary processing and value added food processing, that really creates, you know, other opportunities for higher value crops to be grown. And I think that's an evolution thing. So I think there is certainly a good mix there. And I think producers are savvy enough that, you know, in order for them to kind of make ends meet, they've, you know, sometimes that's just the reality of the economy. They've got to be chasing that dollar. If they can see an opportunity to grow barley and sell it to a feedlot or feed their own cattle, they'll do that. If they see an opportunity to grow seed canola or processing potatoes or whatever, they will move into that if it necessitates. You know, necessitates that. So an economy scale economy thing.
Or like the farmer who I heard about who was growing peppermint, because it would really be adding a lot of value and people wanted that.
Slightly different for you, but similar, Shannon, is you examined the PFRA's community pasture program, and it ran into conflict with increased efficiency, agriculture efficiency, and helped those who were trying to make a go of it on the land that was marginal in nature. So how was that conflict managed? The conflict between community pasture programs and increasing agriculture efficiency. So did we see a disconnect between those two things with that program?
I suppose I'm curious about what we mean when we say efficiency in this context. Is that, do we mean cheapness? Like, are we talking about minimizing the need for public investment to sustain these operations? When we think about community pastures, we can think about them as a means of using areas of land that are difficult to maintain under more intensive forms of agriculture. But we can also look at community pastures as repositories for biodiversity in a prairie landscape that's increasingly hostile to forms of life that aren't fed into streams of agricultural production. Community pasture lands provide opportunities for wildlife that has more difficulty navigating more heavily cropped environments to continue to flourish on the prairies, or at least continue to hold on. And so I think there's lots of scope for thinking really carefully about what we mean when we say efficiency, and also ensuring that our conversation encompass the prospect of other goals for our public policy leaders.
When I threw that question to Jenny, so my apologies, I was getting at what you got at in your book, that with the PFRA, they were trying to get submarginal land out of production in terms of growing crops and use it as community pasture. But they'd find that the farmers would have a good year and they'd want to use that submarginal land, and they really didn't want to turn it over to a community pasture, that sort of thing. So that's what I was getting at when I threw that one to Jenny.
I think that was one of the, you know, last really successful programs that the PFRA had was their perennial forage cover program, where they, you know, they basically paid producers to put, you know, marginal farmlands back into perennial forages. And, you know, I know that there was a lot of producers in this part of the world that took advantage of that. And for many years, you've seen a lot of acres in, you know, permanent cover, you know, whether it was agronomic alfalfa, brome, like whatever. But it was, you know, that really pushed a lot of those marginal lands back into perennial cover. And you're seeing that now with the PFRA no longer obviously existing, and that program, you know, no longer existing, where a lot of those lands through the, you know, I'll say the early 2000s were put back into perennial forages. They're coming out of that perennial cover now, and they're being put back into annual crop production. And, you know, I think to me personally that was a real, you know, loss when they scuttled the PFRA was, you know, just that perennial forage cover program, because that, you know, whether it was $20 an acre, I think if you seeded something more native, they maybe compensated more. But, you know, even that $20 an acre, you know, it helped producers, you know, make that decision to get some of these marginal lands back into, you know, more kind of consistent cover, whereas you're seeing a lot of that come out right now.
Yeah, I think you raised such a great point, Shannon, when you spoke about define what efficiency is, because I think there is a lot of assumption around efficiency being what we're producing on the landscape rather than what can the landscape can sustain for us long term based on leaving those key areas in place, which I've come to learn, I believe it was from you, Shannon, is that those marginal areas do serve the ecosystem long term if they are left to be natural and allow that biodiversity and everything to stay in place. Just a follow-up for you, Jordan, with farms becoming larger and larger, and you mentioned earlier the population has quite dramatically dropped from where it was today, but are we at risk of seeing more depopulation from this? You know, rather what seems to be an increasing agricultural land base?
Well, like, I wish I had a crystal ball for that question, Jenny. I don't know if I could really give you a firm answer. I mean, I suspect yes. I mean, I do think that at some point there is a critical mass of settlement that, you know, whether you can drop below that threshold and still really function as a community. I mean, those are things that I wonder about often. But I think, you know, on the reverse side of that, the question is like, how big is a, practically speaking, how big can farms actually get when you start seeing producers farm, you know, 25 or 30 or 45,000 or 100,000 acres? Like how big can they actually get? But yes, that is a real true issue, I think. And, you know, I look at the, you know, the example in my brain is, you know, when you go back to the late 70s, early 80s, when a family farm, you know, they successfully farmed 1,000 acres. And so then now you have, you know, farm operations, not all of them, but some of them might be farming 30,000 acres, for example. You know, that's taking the place of 30 family farms, you know, in the hands of one single operation. So I think it's bound to change the landscape in terms of settlement and rural depopulation. Like that truly does have an impact. But, you know, I don't know if I would go as far to say that, you know, rural depopulation is just strictly a function of farm size. Like I don't believe that. I think it's obviously other natural resource, primary production, oil and gas, like all that stuff kind of feeds into it. So I don't think it's just simply a factor of farm size, but yes, I think it does have an impact. Will it continue to have an impact? Again, I wish I had a crystal ball for that. I suspect in some ways it does, but I'm not sure, you know, where it actually ends up.
Right. I think, yeah, to your point, there's been a lot of move to cities by younger generations, if their farms potentially have been bought up to bigger, not with the family anymore, then there's a lack of reason for folks to stay there. That's certainly one reason, but also just the motivation to be a part of other industries, period. I think that's true as well. We were talking a bit about efficiency. Why don't we try to get in a little bit more into that? So starting with you, Shannon, what advice do you have in terms of managing the conflict between this concept of efficiency, let's say efficiency for production, let's be specific, and supporting the people who often, through no fault of their own, are not farming the best land? So how do we help balance those things? Thank you.
Well, I suppose I was interested in studying the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration in part because I believe in the importance of deliberate state investment in supporting people, whether these people are farmers, whether they're others. I believe in the role of state in contributing to the creation of spaces where non-human nature can thrive as well. You know, I think there's power when people work together through the resources of the state. I think it's really essential that state investments reflect a really careful effort to consider the public interest and to levy state resources in ways that create that consider a range of factors. And one of the things that became really clear for me as I conducted my research on the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration, as sort of a case study of a state lever through time, was that we haven't always done a great job of thinking about what constitutes the public interest in a broad-minded way. And in fact, one of the findings of my work on the PFRA, one of the limitations in conceptions of the public interest that are really evident in the sort of work the PFRA did, is the failure of that agency to adequately consider the interests of Indigenous peoples and to accommodate the needs and perspectives of Indigenous peoples. That is, dealing with that matter, dealing with the specific circumstances of Indigenous peoples in the present, as well as the harmful legacies of the historical operation of colonial institutions, like the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation Administration, is like fundamental to productive ways forward. But I think there's also a broader lesson here about the need to be careful about assumptions about what's in the public interest and to really problematize that term. So, you know, if we need to query what we mean by efficiency, I think we also need to be really careful about the goals we think we're serving through these state agencies. I think it's essential we work together, that we use state levers in appropriate and careful ways, but that we think really hard about how we're doing so.
Well, and if I can segue on that, you talked about the Indigenous people. It was fascinating to see in your book that the laborers in the irrigation fields were, to a fair extent, I don't know, a great extent, Indigenous people.
Yep.
Along with other minorities. Now, were they always treated well? But can you tell us more about their role in the history of irrigation?
Sure. So primarily here, the work that I'm aware of and that I've done pertaining to labor in the irrigated landscape is primarily focused on sugar beets. As Jordan was saying, sugar beets are one of these high value crops that can be really essential to trying to sort of capitalize on some of the economic advantages of irrigation. Sugar beets need a lot of water. They also need a lot of work through the growing season. This is a really labor intensive crop. We're talking about a period before the emergence of the monogerm sugar beet seed. So these plants had to be tended at multiple stages in really onerous ways throughout the growing season. Farmers looking to grow sugar beet needed to secure water, and they also needed to secure labor. This is beyond the sort of work that a family would undertake at sort of under its own auspices, certainly when we get to talking about the larger sugar beet operations. And cheap labor at this time came in the form of Indigenous peoples, came in the form during World War II of interned Japanese people. It came in the form of newly arrived migrants that were deliberately brought in by the CPR with sort of a go-ahead from the Canadian state to help meet the labor needs in the 1920s of sugar beet operators. And so there was this reliance on irrigation water, but also a reliance on cheap labor. And like I keep saying, we need to think about these words in careful ways. Cheap labor sounds like a good thing. But of course, cheap labor means underpaid laborers. And this reliance on underpaid laborers has persisted, you know, into the mid-20th century, right up to the present. As we get into the 60s and 70s, we start to see a reliance on sugar beet farms, on laborers brought in under migrant worker streams. And this is a really difficult way to make a life, to work on a sugar beet farm in this context. And so, you know, when we think about people trying to make a living in these landscapes, we need to think about farmers. This isn't an easy operation by any means. There's a lot of things to balance, and I believe farmers do the best they can. We also need to think about the experiences of other people who moved in these landscapes, who also had really difficult experiences in their own right.
And that would extend up the supply chain, because I'm sure the farmers many times think they're underpaid because of who they have to provide their produce to and whether they're getting value for their efforts.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's another point that I learned from Chris Spearman. He was saying, and I'm not sure, Jordan, if it's the same in the special areas, but that a number of farmers in southern Alberta, or at least in the Old Man, have switched to potatoes because they found that the purchasers are consumers rather than single companies that potentially can corner the market and make those price points really difficult to maintain. Is that something that you've seen? Before we lead into the same question to you, which is, which advice do you have in terms of managing the conflicts between efficiency and supporting people? Did you want to comment on that? Are you seeing different crops in the area, in the special areas?
So I'm going to say no. Like I think that's just a result of kind of our location and distance to markets, Jenny. So, like our irrigators here are really focused on basically growing, you know, the commodity crops that they're familiar with on irrigation, or growing them to provide feed sources for their livestock operation. For them to like diversify into potatoes or sugar beets or, you know, onions or whatever the high value market is, all practically speaking, you know, it's distance to market and you know, getting to those processing facilities. So, you know, I'd say some of the more diverse crops that we would see would be like a seed canola. You know, some producers have dabbled in like sunflower production and some of that, but generally, you know, you're going to see alfalfa being grown on irrigation within special areas where they can get, you know, maybe two cuts of hay off that a year. You know, they might be growing, you know, some durum or hard red spring wheat or whatever the case is, potentially barley for silage or hybrid corn, again, for livestock feed. That would kind of be the extent of the, you know, say the cropping rotation that we'd see, you know, in irrigation within special areas. I'm just really not familiar with anybody that would grow, you know, like potatoes or anything like that. I don't know of that out here.
Yeah. My ignorance. Thank you.
No, that's yeah. Totally a fair question. Cause you would just assume that if there was irrigation, you would be chasing those high value crops. And I feel like a lot of producers out here, if they could find a way to access into those markets, they would fully take advantage of that.
So distance becomes important if you're trying to serve a market.
It certainly does. Yeah, no, it really does, Bob.
Now, the special areas is involved in two proposals, as I understand it, to bring more irrigation to the special areas. You've got the special areas water project, and then with the in cooperation with the MD of Acadia, the Acadia project. Can you talk a little bit about where people are hoping that will go?
Yeah. So both of those are two separate projects, and the first one that you mentioned, the Special Areas Water Supply Project, that was really a project that was conceived, you know, I'd say back in the 80s, and even some of the kind of pre-planning around that probably happened, you know, even into the 50s and just after the creation of the PFRA and the special areas. And you know, the Special Areas Water Supply Project, you know, there was a lot of work happen on it through the 90s and the early 2000s. In PFRA was a strong partner in, you know, kind of the planning and the design phase of that project. And the concept was about diverting water out of the Red Deer River southwest of Stettler, around that Nevis area, and then moving it via a pipe, you know, kind of into the headwaters of the Berry Creek and the Sounding Creek, which kind of would land at, you know, kind of south of Castor on the west side of Highway 36. And then using those, you know, kind of natural formations in the creek channels to then, you know, move water across the landscape. That project was really more, I'd say, about, you know, just getting secure water into the region. There wasn't really a strong component of irrigation on it. And again, that was really a function of, you know, where the water was being moved to. I think there's a lot of lands within kind of that Sounding Creek Plain, the Berry Creek Plain, that are, you know, highly solanetic soil. They're really tough to irrigate. There are pockets of soils within those that are quite good quality for irrigation, but they're, I'll say they're far and few between. So on that special areas water supply project, you know, maybe we could get to 30,000 acres of irrigation on that entire system. And it was an extensive project to move water, you know, across, again, you know, large distances, basically to the eastern portions of special areas from Stellar. It was just a tough project economically, like in terms of annual operations. And you know, to Shannon's point about, you know, allocating public funds to support some of this stuff, it got to be a really tough sell, I think, politically, you know, to move that project forward. So unfortunately, like, again, there was a lot of work that had went into that by, you know, many, many people over the years. But, you know, just kind of recently, the board, you know, had decided to kind of pivot from that project and look at something that was maybe more, I'll say, efficient use of water and resources. And actually, you know, in the kind of the 2020, we were approached by the province and the Canada Infrastructure Bank on looking at irrigation more regionally, in partnership with the MD of Acadia. The MD for years had been looking at their own kind of regional irrigation project on the southern end of their municipality, and they had kind of come up with a project of about 27,000 acres of irrigation out of the Red Deer River, just kind of right along the Saskatchewan border, south of Acadia Valley. So we started doing work with them in 2020 to develop, you know, kind of a broader project. And we looked at the entirety of special areas landscape and the MD, and we did kind of narrow it down to, you know, those portions south of Acadia Valley down to the Red Deer River and then south of the Red Deer River through Pine Moss. Soils that are I'll say suitable for irrigation. They're good quality to irrigate. So they make sense from a soils perspective. And then started looking at, you know, just the volume of water available in the Red Deer River. Again, Bob, you did an excellent job of kind of framing that up front of this conversation, like in terms of the existing allocations on the Red Deer River, not even in the ballpark as compared to the Bow and the Old Man in terms of allocations out of there. So there is water available in the Red Deer Basin, certainly not unlimited. But we started looking at, you know, kind of all the future predictions in terms of, you know, water use on the industrial side, municipal use and demand for the municipalities along the reaches of the Red Deer River, and then looking how much water would really practically be available in the Red Deer River for this project. So kind of where we've landed is, you know, kind of a concept around about 108,000 acres of new irrigation within the boundaries of the MD of Acadia, and then south into special areas through that Bine Loss area. So it's roughly, you know, kind of, not exactly, but about 50% within the MD of Acadia, 50% within special areas on the full 108,000 acres, you know, on either side of the Red Deer River. So,
well, again, you're actually playing a role now very similar to what happened in Shannon's book about the South Saskatchewan project, where government kind of not necessarily walked away from it, but it became the local communities who had to start advocating for these kinds of things. Am I reading that right from your book, Shannon?
Well, if we're talking about the South Saskatchewan regional plan in particular.
Regional plan, sorry, I got the wrong term.
Yeah, no, so that's what we now know as Gardner Dam, the Capel River Dam, and Lake Diefenbaker in central Saskatchewan. This is a project that the PFRA had initially promoted. There were always people on either side of the issue. You know, over time, there was a report of a royal commission that was really negative on it, but Saskatchewan and Ottawa sort of weren't done with the project even after that. One of the interesting things in understanding the ultimate decision to proceed, I think, is that there were really strong community advocates around the project. There was an organization called the Saskatchewan Rivers Development Association that was looking to promote construction of water infrastructure of various sorts throughout this area of Saskatchewan. The primary leaders within that organization were representatives of rural municipalities and sort of advocates for business people in these parts of central Saskatchewan. there wasn't nearly as robust support for this sort of development from farmers. That seems pretty clear in the historical record. In fact, the research I'm doing now to follow up on my study of the PFRA pertains to the irrigation development that hinged on the South Saskatchewan Regional Plan. And it's really a story of conflict between Saskatchewan government that had agreed as part of the 1958 governing agreement signed with Ottawa to proceed with the South Saskatchewan Regional Plan. The Saskatchewan government committed to develop 50,000 acres of irrigation, and the farmers in the targeted area were like, no, we want to stick with our dry land model. We understand it is successful. This became a really sustained and intractable conflict. And I think we see, you know, that conflict around irrigation persists certainly in Saskatchewan. If you're following irrigation in this province at the time, the government, the provincial government is an advocate for further development of irrigation, drawing on Lake Diefenbaker, sort of a move to more fully realize the initial ambitions behind irrigation hinging on this infrastructure. But there's a lot of criticism about the economic viability of the project. And so that contention really persists.
Well, and hydroelectric was a big part of that project. And was that what the business people were looking for, is to be able to have that reliable energy supply?
Certainly, you're absolutely right. This is a multi-purpose project that was intended to serve primarily irrigation and electricity generation. There were also ambitions to sort of create recreational opportunities in this portion of Saskatchewan that was perceived to have relatively few. But irrigation itself was really understood as an essential economic motor. Irrigation, and this is part of the critique that dryland farmers who wanted to persist in dryland farming brought to bear on the project, is that irrigation changes the form of agricultural production. It's a really different model in terms of work. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more expensive. So you may get higher returns, but the investment is also sky high. And so that means your margin might not actually be all that different. You might have different sorts of problems than a dry land farmer, but your economic returns aren't necessarily substantially better. Who does very clearly benefit from investment irrigation are the firms that are involved in construction. You know, there's opportunity for engineering and construction work that just otherwise wouldn't exist. It can serve to change population distribution in ways that create opportunities for business of various sorts. And so irrigation is often, or historically at least, I'm far less expert in the present day, we can turn to Jordan for that or others. Historically, it's been seen as a really strong economic motor, but farmers who are skeptical often say, but how much ends up in our pockets? And I think there's reason to think hard about that question.
Agreed. Well, thank you guys. This has been a wonderful start to this conversation. I'm sure that we would love your input in the future conversations that we're going to host at the end of these, if that's possible for you. But can you, I would love to do just some closing thoughts and takeaways from each of us, especially if there's anything that you would have liked to touch on that we haven't. But I'll just lead for myself. I really appreciate this concept of revenue versus income. I think really looking at how people are making money on the landscape for less inputs. I'm with you, Shannon, in terms of being concerned about a lot of moving parts makes for, you know, potentially a lot of missteps and that final income for the end user, for the landowner or for the producer. And then also just this concept of public interest. I think this is something that we really need to investigate, not only from a, you know, you were mentioning businesses potentially being successful in this or construction systems, but maybe not the end user again. And then this concept of also truth and reconciliation coming into it. And are we really looking at how the land can be sustained long-term and be more equitable for the people using it? So thank you so much. I really appreciate all of that. So I don't know which one of you wants to start. Maybe I'll let Bob, if you wouldn't mind just giving some of your takeaways first before we let these two hit on anything that we missed.
Fascinating and very informative discussion. I really appreciated it. And I need to be better about defining my terms, certainly.
Go ahead, Jordan.
No, I really appreciate the invite into this conversation. I'll admit, at first I thought, well, maybe this is an odd fit for special areas. Again, just because we're not known as an irrigation hub, but certainly an organization and communities that have always pursued like secure water. And again, because we recognize what water does just in terms of stability and economy and, you know, security to community. So that's always been a grand ambition of ours. And I'm glad that you've connected us. And I really appreciate Shannon's insight into this too, because I've struggled with the history of, you know, the creation of irrigation, you know, in Western Canada and how it came to be. And I think when I look at the province of Alberta, you know, we haven't built a new irrigation district here in 70 years. And, you know, we're trying to do that now. And just, it's an interesting, you know, kind of context to build an irrigation district, you know, in 2025 with, you know, some of the exact issues that we have talked about here.
Go ahead, Shannon, you can close us off with your thoughts, please.
Goodness. Yeah, just appreciation for the perspectives that everybody's brought to this. It's a pleasure to be in touch, Jordan. I hope, you know, we might have opportunities to continue sharing information. And Jenny and Bob, it's great to be a part of this. I suppose, I mean, I'm the historian, so I'm always about, let's define the terms, or what do we mean in this particular context? So forgive me as I do that again a little bit. I mean, the PFRA, I chose to study the PFRA, as I've already said, because it was an interesting historical example to me of how we can use state resources to work together and serve public aims. And in the same way that we sometimes valorize notions of efficiency, we can also valorize notions of small government. And, you know, we can valorize them because they seem more efficient. But we have the potential to use levers of government to work toward bigger goals than we can pursue on our own. And so I think there's a reason to think hard about the prospects for collaboration through these sorts of levers, that there's real possibility, I think, for doing things better. And we should resist efforts to inappropriately dismiss those sorts of options, I suppose.
Yeah, let's learn from what failed in the past potentially and try and do things differently. And as Bob said, when we let off, keep the things that worked as well. Thank you so much, guys. This is a wonderful start. I will end it there. We'll be in touch soon, I'm sure. And I'm so glad that we've connected some new people in some new ways. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.